Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I'm Megan Boxall, podcast editor at the Investors Chronicle, filling in because we've got a bit of a staff absence today, but I think we're going to do a great podcast anyway. And I'm joined by Emma Powell, news editor and banking specialist. And that is where we are going to focus a lot today on the big banks. They've all had their results now. And also later in the episode, we're going to be joined by Mark Robinson, who's stuck at home. Apparently all the weather is causing problems on the train, so he's in Surrey, but he's going to be talking to us about Countrywide. So Emma, first of all, big banks. It has been a big couple of weeks for the banks. Which of them has come out of the reporting season looking the strongest?
Yeah, we've just had all the first half results. Not many big surprises, I don't think. I'll come on to this later, but obviously RBS, even that, them returning to dividends wasn't a massive surprise. We kind of expected it maybe, but yeah, if you're talking about who kind of came out best, I'd have to say RBS, just for the simple fact that, you know, it is a milestone moment, as the chief exec said, first dividend in a decade since they were bailed out. Quite a small one, just 2p a share they reckon they're going to declare, and that's basically down to the fact that, obviously, as we found out a few months ago, they've settled with the US Department of Justice. They've kind of cleared up making contributions to their pension scheme. Their capital levels now are very high, 16.1%.
Is that the highest?
That's the highest now. Yes, that's very. I mean, that's very high. That's even higher than Lloyd's, and that's including. I mean, it did actually drop. I think it was about 30 basis points after taking into account the kind of DOJ settlement and the pension contribution. But it was because of that really they were able to then to recommence dividends. Obviously, the chief exec did say. I think it was back in May when they actually made the settlement that they. That they were then going to start the conversation with the Prudential Regulatory Authority, which obviously has to approve all kind of banking dividends about it. So we did expect that. Nevertheless, the shares did go up about 3%, which is quite a big move for them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and then they also said potentially they would make additional capital returns from next year, which would be massive if that would be, I don't know, special dividends, share buybacks. But it's really the other actually thing worth mentioning is obviously this is now the last remaining state-backed bank.
Mm-hmm. So the government sold its stake in Lloyds and that's left Lloyds in a potentially more exciting opportunity. It's in a freer position. It can do a bit more than maybe RBS can.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's 62.4%. The government's still got
stake.
It's a big stake. Yeah, it's a big stake. They've only done two share sales so far. The last one was a couple of months ago, obviously following this settlement.
So they've got a seller in the market. RBS.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's not going to do much for the share price.
Well, this is the big point I was going to make was, you know, yeah, the caveats are saying this, the return to dividends, you know, capital levels improved, all this. Because the government does have such a big stake to continue to sell down, we're going to see that. That is obviously going to be an overhang on the shares. Mm-hmm.
So is that why you've kept RBS on a hold? Because you've got all the rest of the big banks on buy tips.
Yes. Yeah. RBS is still a hold. I think obviously it has, you know, it has got rid the DOJ settlement. You know, that was seen as the kind of last big legacy issue. They've got rid of that now. It's mainly on a valuation basis, to be honest. I think it's on about, it's just shy of in line with its forecast net tangible assets, about 0.9 times. Lloyds is on about 1.2. So obviously it is more expensive, but Lloyds got now a pretty solid track record since 2014 of paying out dividends. You know, it's yielding, I think it's yielding just over 5%. Whereas RBS, okay, yeah, we have returned to dividend payments, but it's, you know, it's minute, the yield. I think if you've got something like Lloyds, which would be its closest competitor, you'd argue, I think that's a far better opportunity.
Right. Okay, so with regard to the RBS dividend, though, do you think that's looking relatively secure? Do you think they've waited until they're in a secure enough position before they start paying them again?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, with a capital level like that, definitely.
Okay, so RBS looking all right.
Looking better, definitely yeah. worth a hold. Mm-hmm. Not sure I'd I think there's better opportunities okay. elsewhere.
HSBC is one that you think is a better opportunity. You've got that on a buy. It's got a nice yield, a 5.6% yield at the moment. And they also had results this week. So what's going on there?
HSBC has, it was in our income majors feature, as was Lloyds. That bank, actually, in terms of income, you could argue has been the best. It was kind of a bit of an oddity in the sector because I think it never completely stopped paying a dividend. It did have to cut it in 2009, but it's kept paying the dividend out at 51 cents a share. It's not the most well-covered dividend. You know, it's a high-risk income stock if you are going to buy it. And it is at a slight premium to its kind of closest peer, which you say is Standard Chartered. But it's also got quite a good record of share buybacks. So they've done one this year. They're not going to do any more this year, they expect, which some investors were disappointed about. But the main thing now with HSBC is that they are investing more capital back into the business for growth. I mean, they're obviously big in kind of their Asia pivot, as they call it. So it's focusing very much on growing in the Pearl River Delta.
Near Hong Kong.
Yeah. So they see that as a massive growth opportunity and also digital banking. But it also means obviously that costs. And actually that was the main thing with these results, which some people were disappointed about, because costs have been rising and they've been rising at a rate faster than income. So income was up, but because costs were just greater, obviously the profits dipped. I mean, I don't see that as, I mean, it's, you know, it's not great, is it? But I can see why they're spending that money. Mm-hmm. The capital levels are still within management's target, which is about 13%. I think it's over 14%, their CET1 ratio. And I think as long as they can keep that, as long as they can keep within that target range, I think the dividend looks mm-hmm. secure enough, and that is what it is. It's you're buying that for the dividend, really. Yeah.
And also maybe it's exposure in emerging markets, which makes it potentially a bit more of an exciting big bank than Lloyds or RBS.
Well, exactly. I mean, a lot of the, I guess there's two sides to that, isn't there? Because on the one hand, yes, they would argue, in the same way actually some of the Asia-focused life assurers would argue, there's massive demand for savings products over there. You know, you've got the rising middle class. I was going to say, on the flip side, I guess now that we have all these kind of fears around a potential trade war and all the kind of back and forth between the US and China, I don't know if that could drag on sentiment slightly. But I mean, I wouldn't say it's not just China that's in that predicament at the moment.
No, but HSBC and actually all the banks could in the next few months receive a little bit of a boost from the interest rate rise, which we had in the UK last week. Yeah, so what does this mean for the big banks and also for the smaller ones in the sector? You also cover the challenger banks and you compared those two sectors in your alpha feature, which is online and a great read. So what does this mean for the entire banking sector?
Well, theoretically, it's a good thing, because one of the massive problems during the past few years has not just been, obviously, all these legacy and kind of conduct issues. It's been the fact that with interest rates so low, it's very hard for them to make money. Obviously, mm-hmm. that banks make money by lending. On the flip side, obviously, it's meant they've got very cheap cost of funding. So, you know, they're not paying out very much on deposits. But typically, because you make money from lending over longer term, which they haven't really been able to do, you know, we've had a kind of inverse yield curve, then it's really squeezed their net interest margins. So theoretically, this rise, you know, is a good thing. And there'll be a lag effect. You know, eventually it should be being passed through down into deposit rates. I guess, the main thing to mention is obviously 0.75% is still very low mm-hmm. historically. You know, it's a good thing, but I don't think it's historically very, you know, it's like pre-financial crisis, what did we have? I think it was 5-6%. So it is historically very low. The other potential negative, I think, actually, and perhaps you could argue this is more for kind of the challengers, which have a lot of exposure in buy-to-let lending. I mean, it's a massive part. You know, people like Paragon, when Savings Banks, Charter Court, which listed recently. If the cost of, you know, paying back your mortgage goes up, now, you know, we have this rise in interest rates. Obviously, a lot of people will have locked in, I think, to kind of, you know, 2-year fixed mortgage and things like that. But the danger is if you do get people now that perhaps can't make the interest payments or can't make the payments. I mean, you could then start defaulting on their loans. You could argue that could potentially be a risk of rising interest rates because these challenges are so, they're not very well diversified like the major banks are. I mean, again, I guess on that point, it is a very, you know, it's a small rise.
Yeah. Not to worry too much then.
No.
Okay. So what's your top pick in the challenger sector?
I'd probably go for Paragon, actually. In fact, we did tip that recently. It's not very high. It's trading at a discount to its historical average at the moment. Like I said, it's got exposure to buy to let, but it kind of concentrates on the professional market. So people operating through a limited company, which were exempt from the mortgage interest rate relief reforms. So they concentrate on that market. That market's been growing. They also specialise in kind of complex cases, which because they take so much time to kind of underwrite, a lot of the big banks kind of, for other reasons too, but moved out of that space. But also, I think what I find really attractive about Paragon versus maybe some other challenger banks is the fact that they've got access to the kind of a large base of customer deposits. So they've switched out a lot of the business. They now kind of funnel through Paragon Banking, hence actually the name change, rather than the Paragon Mortgages business. So as we've kind of just discussed, because interest rates have been so low, having customer deposits, you know, you're not paying very high interest rates on those. It's a cheap cost of funding, which obviously benefits their margins. And a lot of the challengers haven't had the same access to those deposits. Okay. So that's, I would say that the fact that they've kind of got a more diverse funding base kind of makes them stick out to me.
Okay, interesting. And well, while we're talking, well, slightly about mortgages and buy-to-let lending, this week there's been some big news from the estate agent sector. So we are going to go to Mark Robinson, who's covered the results of Countrywide. Hi, Mark. You've spent the week looking, well, you haven't spent the whole week, you've had lots of other stuff to do as well, but part of your week has been spent looking at the estate agents, and particularly Countrywide, which had had a pretty disastrous week. What's happened there?
Well, the shares just absolutely tanked through the week there. The company reported its half-year figures, which were not inspiring themselves, but it was accompanied by details of a capital raise, a heavily discounted capital raise.
Shocking. 80%, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's analogous to a fire sale, really. Mm-hmm. And the reasons are pretty well known, and there are, you know, the background to it was covered when we initially put the shares on a sell, which I think Jonas put them on a sell back in, it might have been January 2017.
Good call.
But in the last few months, there's been a couple of profit warnings. The chief executive left. The simple reason, it comes down to leverage, really. Mm-hmm. You know, the debt profile is fairly ghastly. At the half-year period, they owed something in the region of £208 million. Mm-hmm. But more to the point, that represents nearly 5 times adjusted EBITDA cash profits.
And nearly 6 times their current market cap.
Well, yeah, I mean, anyway, you look at the metrics, it's bizarre, really.
Yeah.
So they had about 37.8 million in cash at that period end. 30 million of that was linked to a £30 million drawdown on their credit facility. They're sailing pretty close to the wind because they had interest payments, cash interest payments last year of about £4 million, and then the £21 million operating outflow as well. So, you know, when you add all up that together, I mean, they're in a position where they really just had to go back and mm-hmm. I suppose senior debt was out of the question.
Yeah.
So they had to go back to the market and basically almost give the shares away.
Yeah, well, you've described it as game over if this fundraising doesn't go as planned.
Yeah, I mean, I think I quoted I used a quote from the actual issue document itself.
Yeah, the quotes were so worrying. Under the terms of the amended credit facility, the group's lenders could, following a short negotiation period, demand repayment of all borrowings which the group cannot afford.
Yeah, that's fairly explicit, really.
Yeah.
I think it's a case as well when it came around to the audit. The auditors wouldn't be able to sign off the accounts as a going concern. So, I mean, there's nothing really they could do. They could maybe sell off some of their assets, but that would have been unsatisfactory as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when we looked at the tip initially, one of the points that we made is that because of its debt, you know, it's... you know, it's referred to sometimes as operational gearing.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got a high fixed cost base, it ensures that margins rise when revenues go, or they rise disproportionately. But of course, if you hold to that view, the opposite also applies.
Yeah.
And a lot of volume has been taken out of that market, and it's almost as if countrywide's problems have been.
Yeah, it's been tough to be an estate agent. Especially in the UK in the last few years, but actually we had results from Savills today, and they weren't too bad. They weren't great, but they weren't.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not nearly the kind of position that Countrywide is in.
We had the same thing with the Foxtons a few days before Countrywide as well, and they've got a particular focus on London, and London, in relative terms, has been hit pretty hard.
Mm.
It's just that the volume's got out of the market, and the pricing itself, there isn't really any price discovery out there because the volume's been taken out of the market. And like, where you're selling sort of bread, fish, or real estate, you know, once that goes, it's very difficult to find what the lay of the land is regarding the pricing itself.
If you haven't followed our advice, which we've been giving for over a year and sold yet, what should you now do in this rather unfortunate position?
Well, I mean, it's there isn't much of an option, really. You probably should take them up, because otherwise, mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure what would be the value of the breakup of the company, because it could actually come down to that.
Yeah.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't, sort of thing.
Yeah. So shareholders get to vote about this fundraising on the 28th of August.
Yeah.
So we're recommending that they agree to it and then take up their shares.
Yeah, I mean, it's not all bad from an operational perspective, because, I mean, after the former chief executive left at the end of, or the beginning of this year, I think it must have been, Alison Platt, it'd be unfair just to lump all the blame on her doorstep, but she was a bit of a controversial figure. She didn't really have a background in the state agency, had never really worked in that industry, and I think she was coming out from a different angle. I think she'd had a fairly lengthy stint in Bupa, of all places, so I'm not quite sure how that prepared. But they've rejigged the board since then. They've brought in some industry professionals. Paul Crefield, who's ex-Rightmove, he's managing director now, and Paul Chapman, who was with Halifax, he's the chief operating officer, and you can imagine just how busy he's going to be as well.
Yeah.
But Mr. Crefield has subsequently put the rumours to bed that they were thinking of selling off their premium brands, John Wood and Hamptons. It's a three-year program. They're going to try and get back to what they do best, or what they thought they used to do best. The only other thing we can mention is that, as Jonas said back in 2017, obviously it's an industry which is in transition. Only about 7%, or 6 or 7% at the moment, the market is taken up by non-conventional real estate sales, but this percentage is bound to grow. You've got people like Purple Bricks, obviously, in the market now, and they're disrupting that. So I think the good people at Countrywide will be actually looking at 5, 10, 15 years hence, because of that business model of the high street, high fixed costs. It may well become a thing of the past.
Okay. Interesting. Thanks very much, Mark.
Okay, thanks a lot, Megan.
And now let's talk about the cover feature this week, which is The Real Deal, and it's all about private equity. And Emma, you and James Norrington have had a look at how private investors can get into this private equity, which to me has always seemed like a bit of an elusive club. I mean, it does conjure up images, and actually James did write this about the film Wall Street and Gordon Gekko and that sort of image of a very high net worth individual. But you've looked at how it is actually accessible to a wider group of investors. So what is the private equity market? How does it work, and how can normal investors get into it?
Yeah, I think you are actually right in saying that it comes across as a bit of a private members club. Mm. Basically, the way it works is you have a private equity firm or a limited partner who will raise money, need to raise money for, you know, investing in whatever kind of asset, company, opportunities they see. So it's traditionally, I guess, kind of pension funds. It's become very popular with those, I guess, institutional investors, you know, fund managers. Mm-hmm. And then you may have some high net worth individuals. They would be known as general partners. They would all invest into that. But, you know, they wouldn't have, you know, they wouldn't be making investment decisions. Mm-hmm. And then from there, really, I guess the question how then would retail investors access it? It would typically be through kind of listed investment trusts, mm-hmm. a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Because like I said, to invest in one of these funds, the minimum commitment is usually around $10 million, which is a bit out of the reach of the normal investor. So yeah, that would basically be through an illicit investment trust or a kind of venture capital trust. That would be the way, because obviously it's just listed, you could just buy a share. Yeah.
So why would you do that rather than investment in traditional assets?
Well, I guess the big push, and I know this actually as well from, funnily enough, when I used to cover pensions, the rise of private equity has been because interest rates have been so low. People are looking for something that maybe is not an equity, because people see that obviously it's high risk. Although actually, I'd argue private equity is also high risk. Mm-hmm. But they're basically looking for yield, and when you can't get that across, you know, bonds, things like that, they've turned to alternatives. So that mm-hmm. could be private equity. It could be real estate, infrastructure, where, you know, you're locking in money for a lot longer term, and that is a risk also, mm-hmm. You know, that they are illiquid investments. But that's really why it's just the search for yield. And there's, I guess some people would argue they're not correlated with equities, although I kind of, as we discuss in the feature, would dispute that a little bit, just because why wouldn't the same kind of, you know, macroeconomic factors impact an unlisted company as they would a listed company?
Yeah, that seems logical. But, as you point out in the feature, private equity companies have actually performed pretty well over the last few years. You would have made a good return on your investment had you been invested in private equity. And as James points out, maybe there is a slight difference between private equity and traditional assets, in that the private equity investors have so much knowledge on the specific companies, which institutional investors don't necessarily have that level of knowledge, because it's not quite as accessible as if you are a private company and you don't have to report to the markets. But then that also is an issue with private equity, isn't it, in that it's not terribly opaque for your average Joe investor.
Well, yeah, that is the issue, obviously. You invest in an equity, they've got a I think it's just twice yearly reporting now, isn't it? But most do quarterly updates. You know, you can see that you could go to an AGM if you wanted to, you know, and speak to management directly. Whereas, yeah, if you're investing in a private equity and you're a retail investor, particularly, you know, you're investing in an investment trust who is then investing in, who is just one partner in a fund, and it is opaque and it's difficult to maybe understand how assets are being valued. You know, how much influence is that institutional investor going to be able to have on the management of the, you know, the company, the end investment? I'd argue not really any. Mm-hmm. You know, the limited partner would, obviously, because they would be the majority owner or have a big stake maybe in the company. So that is the issue, I guess, the accountability issue. Mm-hmm.
And also, more recently, value is becoming a bit of a thing to be looking at in private equity, and how much these vehicles are having to pay for their investments because there isn't an awful lot of value to be found in the markets.
Well, yeah, that's been one of the big problems. I think the stat is there's been $3 trillion raised in the past 5 years by private equity funds. But the issue now is that there's now so much competition for good investments, and not just from other private equity investors, but also sovereign wealth funds and actually other companies that just want to merge or buy up assets. Because mm-hmm. obviously you've had, with low interest rates, you've obviously had cheap debt. Mm-hmm. So now is the time, I guess, if you are a company, you can borrow cheaply. You want to be doing bolt-on acquisitions and things. You know, now's the time to do it. So that is an issue. Mm-hmm. And actually there is data that shows, you know, the deal multiples are peaking and are actually above, well, I guess we don't know whether they're peaking, they could continue rising, but they're rising now. And I guess I think the average for the US and Europe is now higher than just before the financial crisis. So wow. People are paying more, basically.
Yeah. It's actually an interesting link with our lead news story this week, which is about the animal healthcare market and CVS Group, which is a vet's owner. It's a listed company. You can buy shares in it, but it's being outcompeted or it's having to compete very hard to buy vets practices because private equity is so interested in it, and they're just hiking the prices of these vets practices and it's causing a problem for them. So they're kind of outpricing each other, which doesn't look great for either party there. But overall, what do you think about the private equity market? Would you recommend investing in this sector?
It's a tricky one. I mean, I think there are some opportunities. We've actually included a table which has kind of Z scores. It's a kind of metric Algae looks at that kind of denotes value, basically. I think there definitely are some opportunities. I think things to be aware of are the fees are high, I guess, because of the amount of due diligence by the managers that you have really got to think about kind of locking your money away, leaving it invested for a long time, typically around 5 years. And I guess the other thing is the fact that this would be a small proportion of your portfolio. I mean, probably less than 10%. Mm-hmm. This is a small thing. I guess it is an element of diversification, but yeah, it's for somebody also with a higher risk appetite, just because I think of how opaque it can be, really.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, it's all very interesting, and actually it's something I wasn't really aware of at all before you wrote this feature, so my knowledge has expanded, thank you. And thanks for joining me, and thanks to Mark too for joining us on the phone. All the usual comments in the magazine, and I'm doing my best John Human impression here, and loads of results as always during this busy results season. And John will be back next week with the next episode of the Companies and Markets Show. But for now, pick up The Real Deal: Why You Can't Afford to Ignore Private Equity in All Good News Agents. Thanks for listening.
Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.